that are the most dangerous. My cab pulled up to the airport, and I slung my duffel bag over my shoulder, but it felt heavier than before. I dragged my feet through the terminal. The view outside the windows darkened as the San Francisco fog rolled in. I made my way to my gate, and I couldn't stop wondering. How could I have been so blind to something so obvious? How did I not even know I was part of the problem? I didn't know the answers, but I knew what I had to do first. I headed straight to see my sisters. Chapter 31, Turning Darkness into Light. I rushed home full of questions, but when I sat with my sisters in our living room, I found out I didn't even understand what I didn't understand. You just left an interview with one of the most accomplished women in the world, and all you can talk about is that she got hit on by her mentor? That was Brianna. She's 3 years older than me, was in her third year of law school, and for as long as I've known her, she's been fighting for what she believes. Even during the interview, Brianna continued, when you asked Goodall about it again, she told you it wasn't a big deal. Her response to Leakey's advances was everything I hope I would do if I was in that situation. She stood up from the couch. I think I know why you were so upset. It's because you see a sexual advance as an act of disrespect. Sometimes it is, but it isn't always. For my whole life, you and Dad were always like this. Dad made it clear that if a guy even showed interest in me or Talia, it was an act of aggression, which is why you got so triggered. And I'm surprised it took you this long to realize that women deal with these kinds of things all the time. You've been living with women your entire life. You grew up with two sisters, a mom, and 9 girl cousins who were your best friends. I can even remember you reading I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings in high school. If anybody should have realized this stuff earlier, it should have been you. My gaze lowered, and I stared at my feet. When I looked over to my younger sister, Talia, she was sitting there quietly, taking it all in. I knew I'd be hearing from her soon. I'm not trying to make you feel bad, Brianna added. I'm just trying to make a point. If even you didn't understand the issues women face, and you grew up surrounded by women, imagine what it's like for guys who didn't. A silence settled over the room, and then Talia took out her phone. She pulled up a meme on Facebook, put the screen in front of my face. It was a picture of two people running a race. In the left lane was an older white man in a suit with a couple hurdles in his way. In the right lane was a young black woman with shackles locked to her leg, barbed wire in front of her, an alligator, a brick wall, and spears. And at the bottom is a line of dialogue from the man. What's the matter? It's the same distance. As I stared at the image, Talia said, I bet you're focusing on the wrong part. It's not all the extra obstacles women face that bothers me. It's that sentence on the bottom. It's the fact that most men won't even acknowledge our reality. There are problems women face that most men will never understand because they never try to understand. It's hard to know for sure why I hadn't experienced Maya Angelou's memoir the way Brianna assumed I had. When I had read I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings as a teenager, I was so overwhelmed by the African-American experience that it was all I had focused on. Maya Angelou was born in an era where you could see a black man dangling from a tree, or look out a window and see hooded Klansmen setting fire to a cross. When Maya Angelou was 3 years old, she and her 5-year-old brother were placed on a train car, all alone, headed to the South, with nothing more than a name tag tied to their feet. Angelou and her brother were received by their grandmother, and taken to her home in Stamps, Arkansas, a town clearly divided between blacks and whites. Only now, as I picked up Maya Angelou's memoir again, did I try to see it through the lens of her gender. One afternoon, when she was 8 years old, Angelou was headed to the library when a man grabbed her arm, yanked her toward him, pulled down her bloomers, and forced himself on her. He then threatened to kill her if she told anyone what had happened. When Angelou finally reported who raped her, the man was arrested. The night after his trial, he was found dead, kicked to death behind a slaughterhouse. Shaken and traumatized, Angelou internalized it as if her words caused that man to die. For the next 5 years, Angelou didn't speak. As time wore on, she was faced with even more obstacles. She got pregnant at 16, worked as a prostitute and madam, and was a victim of domestic violence. At one point, a boyfriend drove her to a romantic spot by the bay, beat her with his fists, knocked her unconscious, and kept her captive for 3 days. These events, though, are not what define her. What defines Maya Angelou is how she turned darkness into light. She channeled her experiences into works of art that made waves in American culture. She became a singer, dancer, writer, poet, professor, film director, and civil rights activist, working alongside Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X. She wrote more than 20 books, and I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings spoke so directly to the soul of readers that Oprah Winfrey has said, "Meeting Maya on those pages was like meeting myself in full. For the first time, as a young black girl, my experience was validated." Angelou has won 2 Grammy Awards and was the second poet in American history, preceded only by Robert Frost, to recite a poem at a presidential inauguration. And now, I was about to pick up the phone and give her a call. A friend of mine had helped arrange the interview. Angelou was 85 years old and had recently been discharged from the hospital, so the interview was just 15 minutes long. My goal was simple. Not only to ask the questions my sisters had come up with, but to listen and hopefully understand. My sisters boiled down their questions into 4 obstacles. The first was how to deal with darkness. There's an expression Maya Angelou coined called rainbows in the clouds. The idea is that when everything in your life is dark and cloudy and there's no hope in sight, the greatest feeling is when you find a rainbow in your cloud. So I asked Angelou, when someone is young and just starting out on their journey, and she or he needs help finding that rainbow and mustering that courage to keep going, what advice do you have? "I look back," Angelou said, her voice soothing and wise. "I like to look back at people in my family, or people I've known, or people I've simply read about. I might look back at a fictional character, someone in A Tale of Two Cities. I might look at a poet long dead. There may be a politician, could have been an athlete. I look around and realize that those were human beings. Maybe they were African, maybe they were French, maybe they were Chinese, maybe they were Jewish or Muslim. I look at them and think, I'm a human being. She was a human being. She overcame all of these things. And she's still working at it. Amazing. Take as much as you can from those who went before you. Those are the rainbows in your clouds. Whether they knew your name or would never see your face, whatever they've done, it's been for you. I asked what someone should do when they're searching for rainbows, but all they see are clouds. What I know, she said, is that it's going to be better. If it's bad, it might get worse, but I know that it's going to be better, and you have to know that. There's a country song out right now, which I wish I'd written, that says, every storm runs out of rain. I'd make a sign of that if I were you. Put that on your writing pad. No matter how dull and seemingly unpromising life is right now, it's going to change. It's going to be better. But you have to keep working. Angelou once wrote, nothing so frightens me as writing, but nothing so satisfies me. When I had shared that quote with my sisters, they had said it resonated with them. In many ways, that applies to any kind of work you love. Brianna's passion for special education law had turned into her dream, but now that dream was turning into a cold reality of applying to firms and wondering if she was good enough. I brought up that quote to Angelou and asked how she dealt with that fear. With a lot of prayer and much trembling, she said, laughing. I have to remind myself that what I do is not an easy thing. And I think that's true when a person begins doing what he or she wants to do and feels called to do, not just as a career, but really as a calling. A chef, when she or he prepares to go into the kitchen, has to remind herself that everyone in the world who can eats. And so preparing food is not a matter of some exoticism. Everybody eats. However, to prepare it really well, when everybody eats some salt, some sugar, some meat if they can or want to, some vegetables, the chef has to do it in a way that nobody has done it before. And so this is true when you are writing. You realize everyone in the world who speaks uses words. And so you have to take a few verbs and some adverbs, some adjectives, nouns, and pronouns, and put them all together and make them bounce. It's not a small matter. So you commend yourself for having the courage to try it. You see? The third obstacle was dealing with criticism. In Angelou's autobiography, she wrote about joining a writer's guild. She read aloud a piece she had written, and the group ripped it apart. You wrote that it pushed you to acknowledge that if you wanted to write, I said, you had to develop a level of concentration found mostly in people awaiting execution. In the next 5 minutes, Angelou said, laughing again. It's true. What advice do you have for a young person who's dealing with criticism and looking to develop that same level of concentration? Remember this, she said. I'd like you to write this down, please. Nathaniel Hawthorne said, easy reading is damn hard writing. And that's probably just as true the other way around. That is, easy writing is damn hard reading. Approach writing, approach whatever your job is, with admiration for yourself and for those who did it before you. Become as familiar with your craft as it is possible to become. Now, what I do and what I encourage young writers to do is to go into a room alone, close the door, and read something you've written already. Read it aloud so you can hear the melody of the language. Listen to the rhythm of the language. Listen to it. Before you know it, you'll think, it's not too bad. That's pretty good. Do it so you can admire yourself for trying. Compliment yourself for taking on such a difficult but delicious chore. Obstacle 4 was an issue Brianna was confronting. As she looked for a job, every job description she found said prior experience required. But how could she get prior experience if all jobs require prior experience? In Angelo's autobiography, she faced a similar problem. "I read when you were hired as the associate editor of the Arab Observer," I said. "You bluffed your way into the job by inflating your skills and prior experience, and when you were hired, you had to really learn how to swim. What was that like?" "It was hard," Angelo said, "but I knew I could do it. That's what you have to do. You have to know that you have certain natural skills and that you can learn others, so you can try some things. You can try for better jobs. You can try for a higher position. And if you seem assured, somehow your assurance makes those around you feel assured. Oh, here she comes. She knows what she's doing. Well, the thing is that you're going to the library late at night and cramming and planning while everyone does their thing. I don't think we are born with the art. You know, if you have a certain eye, you can see depth and precision and color and all of that. If you have a certain ear, you can hear certain notes and harmonies, but almost everything is learned. So, if you have a normal brain, and maybe a little abnormal, you can learn things. Trust yourself." I had 1 minute left. I asked if she had just a single piece of advice for young people as they launch their careers. "Try to get out of the box," she said. "Try to see that Taoism, the Chinese religion, works very well for the Chinese, so it might also work for you. Find all the wisdom that you can find. Find Confucius. Find Aristotle. Look at Martin Luther King. Read Cesar Chavez. Read. Read and say, oh, these are human beings just like me. Okay, this may not work for me, but I can use one portion of this. You see? Don't narrow your life down. I'm 85 and I'm just getting started. Life is going to be short, no matter how long it is. You don't have much time. Go to work." As time passed, I became even more grateful for this conversation, because if I had waited much longer, it wouldn't have happened. Almost exactly a year after this phone call, Maya Angelou passed away. Chapter 32, Sitting Down with Death. Months had passed since my conversation with Maya Angelou, and the solace she had given me had washed away. I was experiencing a level of sadness I didn't know I could feel. My dad had just been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He was only 59, and I was watching him wither away. Seeing my dad's full head of hair fall from his scalp, 80 pounds waste away from his body, and hearing him cry in the middle of the night filled me with a pain I'll never be able to fully put into words. There was such a deep sense of despair, of helplessness, as if I was on a raft, looking out at my dad as he drowned in the ocean, spitting up water, and no matter how far I stretched my hand, I couldn't reach him. But as overwhelming as those thoughts were, this wasn't the place to linger in sadness. I was now sitting in the lobby of the Honest Company's headquarters, minutes away from interviewing Jessica Alba, which meant for the next hour, I needed to compose myself, focus on the mission and stop thinking about death. I was escorted down a hallway. Bright sunlight filled the open workspace. On one wall were 100 bronze butterflies. On another were dozens of shining white ceramic mugs spelling out the word honesty. Everything about the company seemed positive and upbeat, and I wanted the interview to be that way too. As I turned a corner and approached Jessica Alba's office, I reflected on the magnitude of what she's accomplished. She's the only person in Hollywood history to simultaneously be both a leading actress and the founder of a billion-dollar startup. The Honest Company has grossed $300 million since its inception, and her movies have grossed an estimated $1.9 billion worldwide. She's also the only person in the world to have been both on the cover of Forbes and Shape magazine in the same month. She didn't climb one mountain and then climb another. She climbed two mountains at the same time. And I was here to find out how she did it. I greeted her and sat on an L-shaped couch in her office. During my research, I had noticed that whenever Alba spoke about her mom, she always had the most uplifting things to say. And a few weeks earlier, while at Larry King's breakfast table, Cal had told me one of his favorite questions is, "What's the best lesson your dad ever taught you?" I thought, if I combined these two elements, we'd immediately go to a positive and profound place. I asked Alba what the best lesson was that she learned from her mom. She took a moment to think, running her fingers over the fringes of her ripped jeans. I sat back, feeling I had hit the bullseye. "I learned," Alba said, "to try to make the most of moments. You know, my mom's mother passed away when my mom was in her early 20s. Don't think about it. Don't think about it." "When I was a mean teenager," Alba continued, "my mom would say, 'You need to be nicer to me because I'm not going to be around forever.'" She paused, almost as though she was looking inside herself. "You just never think life's gonna stop," she said. "Until it stops." I couldn't take it anymore. I had to redirect the conversation. I had seen YouTube clips where Alba glowed as she told the story of how she started her company. It went like this. She was 26, pregnant with her first child, and after the baby shower, she was washing a onesie in the laundry and was shocked by the allergens in the child-safe detergent. That inspired her to create a company committed to safe and toxin-free products. In every video clip, Alba's eyes lit up as she talked about helping create happier, healthier lives, which made this the perfect topic. "How did you start the Honest Company?" I asked. "I was thinking about mortality," she said. "My own mortality." "At 26? "When you bring life into the world," she said, leaning forward, "it forces you to see how life and death are so close to each other. You realize this person wasn't here, now they are. Now they can just as easily die. And it's not just a baby that should have access to healthy products. It needs to be everybody. It needs to be me. I don't want to die early. I don't want to get Alzheimer's. I'm terrified of that. My mom's father had it. And then my mom had cancer. My aunt had cancer. My grandmother had cancer. My great aunt had cancer. My cousin's son had cancer. So I just don't want to die." I couldn't speak. But that didn't matter because Alba just kept talking about death and cancer, death and cancer, death and cancer until I became physically nauseous. "My dad just got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer," I blurted. The first time I had ever said those words, I couldn't get them out without tearing. As weeks passed, I could say the words, but I didn't believe it. Now, I just felt numb. Through all my stages, the reactions I got were the same. Most people put their arms around me saying everything was going to be okay. Others gave me that kind, soft-spoken, "I'm so sorry," which left me totally unprepared for Alba's response. She slapped her hand down on the couch and said, "Oh shit. Fuck." Her words felt like a bucket of ice water being splashed in my face. And the strangest thing about it was that it lifted a weight off my shoulders I didn't even know was there. From this point on, this no longer felt like an interview. We spent the next 30 minutes talking about cancer and our families. She told me about dealing with her mom rushing to the emergency room, throwing up for 3 days, and then doctors cutting up pieces of her intestines. Alba put her parents on special diets, got them off harmful medications, set them up with a nutritionist, and they both lost 50 pounds. I told her I had set my dad up with a nutritionist who specialized in helping cancer patients, but my dad wouldn't follow her advice or even see her a second time. "It's the craziest thing," I said. "For my parents," Alba replied, "I just had to say, look, if you guys want to be around to see your grandchildren graduate high school or get married, you need to figure it out. It's not okay anymore. You have to do whatever it takes." So they did. Somehow, her words made me feel less alone. "It's just horrible to be sick," she added, letting out a breath. And then, as I hear about more women having endometriosis, hysterectomies, and hormonal cancers, breast cancer, cervical cancer, and all of this, I'm in this rut, you know? I'm just like, what the hell is happening? Obviously, the culprit is a combination of things, but I finally ask myself, what's within my control? And what's within my control is what's in and around my home. "The first time I bought something from your website," I said, "was after my dad's diagnosis. I know this sounds weird, but the cancer makes his bowel movements smell really bad, and I don't want to get him a regular air freshener because I don't know what chemicals are in it. And you guys are one of the only companies with a non-toxic air freshener, you know, the essential oil one." And I told my dad, "This is your best friend. Use this every day." And it helped. Alba's eyes gleamed as if I had just handed her a gift. You and I know that what we put in our bodies, what we're inhaling, what's in our environment, it affects our health, she said. Our parents' generation is like, if I can get it at a store, it's fine. If they're selling it to me, it's okay. And we're like, no, that shit ain't right. It's so hard because our parents are so afraid to try something new. "That's the story of my life," I said. "My grandmother recently found out she has diabetes," Alba went on. "I'm sure she's had it for a while, but she would never go to the doctor. She's had strokes and all that, and they could have easily been diabetes-related strokes, but she won't acknowledge it. So last night, we were at dinner, and my grandpa was giving her all this cake and ice cream, and I was like, she could literally have a seizure right now and go into a coma. What are you guys doing? They just don't want to accept reality." "Scares the shit out of me," I said. "I have no idea how you dealt with it with so many family members. I'm drowning with just one." "I think it's different when it's your dad," she replied. "I feel like as technology gets better and we can save more lives," I said, "the things that are killing us are getting more extreme, the toxins, the pollution. I think that's why we struck a chord," Alba replied, "because people are seeing it. The crazy part, I know you talk a lot about your company helping babies, but you're also doing this for my dad. You're doing it for literally the thing that's hurting me the most." Her eyes widened, and then an epiphany hit me. "This is crazy," I said, lifting off the couch. "All of this," I pointed to the view outside her glass door where some of her 500 employees worked. "All of this is because you grabbed death by the collar, sat it down at the table, and asked yourself, what am I going to do with my life?" Now she looked like she had gotten splashed with ice water. "It's true," she said. "You could have just continued a very successful acting career and been content with that. But instead you..." "Exactly," she said. "It's mind-blowing. Wow, if my energy was so high, I could barely get out a sentence. If we had this conversation 2 months ago, we wouldn't have been talking about any of this. I never had to think about death before, but now I see your company in an entirely new way. Many celebrities create businesses that are a reflection of their lives on the mountaintop. They create fragrances or clothing lines. But Alba created a business that's a reflection of her lowest point. She tapped into her humanity. She created something that resonates with all people. That was her key to ascending her second mountaintop, to first go back down to her deepest valley. Facing death, Alba said, makes you sensitive to how delicate life is. Everything is so, she snapped her fingers, in a moment. It forces you to think about all of your decisions in a different way. What really matters? What are you spending your life doing? What are you going to do when you stare your biggest fear in the eyes? I barely noticed our hour was up, but it didn't matter because we just kept on talking. I took out my phone and pulled up the meme Talia had shown me of the man racing the woman with all the extra obstacles in front of her. I want to see what you think of this, I said. Alba held my phone in her hand and stared at the image. Then she laughed. I had shown the image to a dozen people by now and no one had responded like this. It may have just been in my head, but Alba's laugh seemed to have a hint of sadness. It's funny because it's so true, she said. If everyone could be a white dude in America born into a family that cares about his education, everybody would probably choose that because it's really much easier. Alba continued staring at the meme. I think you can remove some of the hurdles in the road if you surround yourself with the right people, she said. If you try to go it as a lone wolf, if you're just angry and fighting the system the whole time, no one is going to want to be around you because you're always going to be mad fighting the good fight. But if you can run with grace, dignity, and integrity, it makes it a lot easier to get to the finish line. Nobody is in control of who they are when they're born, she continued. You're born into the family you're born into, and you're born into the circumstances you're born into. So you just have to take what you can from where you're at and not compare yourself to other people. You have to look at your path and know that whatever got you there and where you're going is unique to you. You aren't supposed to be any other way. And it's so easy to get distracted, she added. The man in the left lane is still going to get to his finish line. He doesn't care. He may look over at you in the beginning, but then he's off. If you're constantly looking over your shoulder at him, you'll never finish your race. And you know what? The obstacles women face just make for better businesses. Because in the end, we know how to deal with some shit. This man in the cartoon won't be equipped, because you only really learn if you've gone through it. Alba looked at the meme again, and then handed my phone back. What got you so interested in working on this project in the first place? She asked. I told her how I had started out staring at the ceiling and how the journey unfolded. Then she asked if I had found a pattern from my interviews. I'd like your take on it, I said. My theory is that every single one of these people treats life and business like a nightclub. She let out a small laugh. As I told her the rest of the third door analogy, she kept nodding her head. I like that, she said. It's so true. My co-founders and I always say here that it's tough to find job candidates who are intelligent and focused, but who are also dreamers. The dreamer part is that entrepreneurial spirit where if this door is closed and that door is closed and that door is closed, how the hell are you going to get in? You just need to figure it out. You need to use common sense, build relationships. I don't care how you get in, but you've got to get in somehow. So you literally hire based on the third door, I asked, laughing. Yes, I don't care where you got your degree. I don't care about your past work experience. I care about how you solve problems. I care about how you take on challenges. How do you create new ways of doing things? It's about having that hustle, that drive. That's everything when it comes to the best people here. It's all about the third door. Chapter 33. The Imposter. The founder of TED had told me, I live my life by two mantras. One, if you don't ask, you don't get. And two, most things don't work out. And now I had just made my most far-fetched ask yet, and it was working out better than I could have imagined. I had asked Chi Lu if he would introduce me to Mark Zuckerberg over email, and Chi immediately responded saying he'd be happy to. I looked around the storage closet, shaking my head in disbelief. Just 3 years earlier, I had to crouch in a bathroom to talk to Tim Ferriss. Now, a single email connected me to Mark Zuckerberg. Following Chi's advice, I drafted a paragraph telling Zuckerberg about the mission and that I was attending startup school, a conference he was scheduled to speak at the following week. I asked if we could meet there. Chi then Facebook messaged my note to Zuckerberg, and 16 hours later, I got this. To Alex Benayan, CC, Stefan Weitz, from Chi Lu. No subject. Here is what I got back from Mark. Sure, please pass along my email address to him, and I'll try to find a few minutes to speak to him before I have to leave. I can't promise I'll have time, but if I have a few minutes, then I will meet him. Best Chi. I knew exactly who I wanted to call first. Holy shit, Elliot said. Elliot talked with a level of excitement that sounded like trumpets blasting the most triumphant song I had ever heard. He advised me to write an email that wouldn't require much on Zuckerberg's part, so he could easily reply with, "Sounds good." Elliot helped draft the email, and I sent it off. To Mark Zuckerberg, CC Chi Lu, from Alex Benayan. Subject, see you Saturday. Hi, Mark. Chi Lu told me about your reply and passed along your email address. Chi's been like a guardian angel the past few years, and I'm so grateful for him. And he said incredible things about you. I can pop by backstage after your speech at startup school for a couple of minutes. If you end up not having time to talk, totally understand. Does that sound good? Either way, I really appreciate you, and thanks for being such a big inspiration. I paced across the storage closet and refreshed my email every hour, but there was no reply. 2 days before the event, I emailed Chi again, asking if it was okay to send a follow-up message. Chi replied asking what I was talking about. Mark replied to almost immediately. That's impossible. Wait, what if I checked my spam folder? Viagra, 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 Mark Zuckerberg, Viagra, Viagra, Viagra. Even Gmail couldn't believe Mark Zuckerberg would email me. To Alex Benayan, CC, Chi Lu, from Mark Zuckerberg. Subject, see you Saturday. Good to meet you. Chi is a great person, and I'm glad you got connected with him. I'll try to make a few minutes for us to catch up after my startup school talk on Saturday. I don't have much time, but I'm looking forward to meeting you briefly. I forwarded Zuckerberg's and Chi's emails to the startup school event organizer, gave her the contacts, and asked how I should get backstage. Then I called Elliot and told him the good news. Don't send Zuckerberg another email, Elliot said. But shouldn't I confirm? I asked. No, never oversell. He already said yes. At this point, all you have to do is show up. Although that didn't feel right in my gut, I'd ignored Elliot's advice too many times in the past, only to find out he had been right. I wasn't going to make that mistake again. Well, Mr. Big Shot, congratulations, Elliot said. You have a meeting with the Zuck. Welcome to the big leagues. One day later, Palo Alto, California. The restaurant was packed and our table was crowded with pita, hummus, and chicken kebabs. It was the night before the startup school event, and I was having dinner with Brandon and Corwin, who would be coming with me the following day. As the waiter placed our bill on the table, I checked my email and saw the event organizer's reply. Hi, Alex. I'm unable to grant your request for tomorrow. I will need any requests to come from Mark's team. I replied explaining I didn't know anyone on his team and that I had been introduced through Chi Lu. The event organizer didn't respond. Each passing hour made me more nervous. I emailed again, but heard nothing back. Late that night, I emailed a friend from Summit who knew the team organizing the event. I told him the situation and asked what to do. The following morning, he messaged me back. Is your email from Zuck legit? The head of the event just emailed me saying you tried to get backstage by sending a fabricated email from Zuckerberg. Corwin and Brandon huddled around my laptop in the kitchen of Corwin's parents' house. Just email Zuck and explain what's going on, Brandon said. I don't think it's a good idea, I replied. Elliot told me to play it cool. Dude, it's just an email, Corwin said. My lips pressed. Fine, if you're not going to email Zuck, Corwin went on, then at least email Chi Lu. I shook my head. I know if I just see the event organizer face to face today and let her go through the emails on my phone, it will clear this all up. They don't have to bother Chi Lu about this. I shut my laptop and we headed for the car. Half an hour later, Corwin turned a corner and pulled into the outdoor parking lot of De Anza College. The three of us climbed out and looked around at the campus's beige buildings. Hundreds of attendees sprawled the grounds, most carrying laptops and iPads. The line for the main entrance curved around the building. I spotted another entrance in the back of the building, where I assumed VIPs enter to go backstage. I sped over to the main registration table and asked to speak to the event organizer. After a few minutes of waiting, I was told she wouldn't see me. There was no chance I was going to miss my meeting with Zuckerberg. I frantically tracked down the event organizer's phone number, and she answered. Hi, this is Alex Benayan, the person who emailed you last night about my meeting with Mark Zuckerberg. Let's cut to the point, she said. We know you forged that email. We contacted Mark's PR team, and they said they don't have you on their list of approved meetings. We contacted Facebook's security team, and they said they have no record of you. And on top of all that, we know that's not even Mark's real email address. If I were you, I would drop the act before you get yourself in serious trouble. Goodbye. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid of being overly persistent in bothering Chi Lu on a Saturday afternoon, but I needed help. I figured I could call Stefan Weitz, who worked with Chi at Microsoft. Stefan answered immediately and said he would handle it. A minute later, I was CC'd on an email to the event organizer. Stefan assured her the email was 100% real, and if she still had any concerns, she could call him on his cell. 2 hours passed. The event organizer still hadn't replied to Stefan's email. I texted him the event organizer's phone number. Stefan called, but she didn't answer. I was running out of options. There was an hour to go until Zuckerberg's speech, and I didn't have a backup plan. I sent another email. To Mark Zuckerberg, CC Chi Lu, from Alex Benayan. Subject, see you Saturday. Just got a startup school and the staff is being tricky about being backstage. Should I still try to come back there for a few minutes or is there a simpler place for us to catch up? I checked my watch a bit later. 30 minutes left. There was no response from Zuckerberg, so I decided to take matters into my own hands. It made sense that Zuckerberg would arrive through the VIP entrance on the other side of the building. When he was getting out of his car, maybe I could tell him I was the person Chi Lu introduced him to, and then Zuckerberg could tell the event organizer who I was. It was the only plan I could think of, so Brandon, Corwin, and I walked over to the driveway leading up to the speaker's entrance. We found a large, shady tree and sat down. A bit later, as we were talking and fidgeting with twigs on the ground, I noticed a man's head emerge from around the corner, then disappear. A minute later, the same man popped out again, whispered into a radio, and then disappeared once more. Before I knew it, the silhouettes of a woman and a much larger man were moving toward me. They stopped a couple yards away, as if they didn't want to get too close. The walkie-talkie in the man's hand made it clear he was security. He took a step forward and glared down at me. "Do you mind if I ask what you're doing here?" the woman said. I recognized her voice. "Hi, I'm Alex," I said, lifting my hand, giving a gentle wave. "I'm the person who..." "I know who you are," the event organizer said. "Why are you sitting under this tree?"
We're sitting here because our car is parked right there and we just wanted some fresh air."
My car was parked right there, but she and I both knew the real reason I was under this tree. I wish I had the courage to say, "Look, I know you think I'm an imposter, and I know you're just doing your job, but I have to do my job too. A president of Microsoft introduced me to the founder of Facebook, and the last thing I'm going to do is not show up. If you don't believe my email is real, that's on you. By all means, ask Mark when his car pulls up." But I couldn't say any of that. I just stared at her. Her eyes hardened.
"I know what you're trying to do," she said. "You need to leave the premises immediately."
The security guard took an ominous step forward.
"If you don't leave now," he said, "we'll call the police."
I imagined Zuckerberg's car pulling up and him stepping out, seeing me with my arms handcuffed behind my back, blue and red lights flashing, and as I'm hauled away, I'm screaming, "Mark, please tell them we have a meeting." I lowered my head, told the security guard we didn't want any trouble, and walked away. I couldn't forgive myself. This was the one time I hadn't needed to jump over a dumpster or bang on a door 100 times to use the third door. I sent one email to Chi, and Mark Zuckerberg said, "Come on in." But, of course, the nightclub bouncer saw me, grabbed my arm, and said, "Not so fast, punk." What made me feel even worse was the thought that I had let Chi Lu down. I sent an email explaining what happened. Chi replied within minutes. "Stefan told me about this, and I am sorry things didn't work out. I sent a Facebook message to Mark right after Stefan contacted me, but Mark didn't respond. In retrospect, if you had called me at the time, I could have called the head of the event to let you in. If you can wait, one suggestion is to try this again next year at the next startup school. Because Mark already agreed, it's kind of like a rain check, and I can contact the head of the event beforehand so that he can ask his staff to let you in. If you cannot wait that long, I can try to message Mark again, but I'm not sure whether he will respond, as he didn't for the previous message I sent." I thanked Chi and asked if he could try one more time now. My thinking was that it was never going to be fresher in Zuckerberg's mind. If it would ever happen, it would be now. Chi sent Zuckerberg a second message. 3 days later, Chi emailed me back. I sent the message to Mark via Facebook message on Thursday, and so far Mark has not responded. Following past patterns, this unfortunately means that Mark is not open to that possibility, as otherwise he would have responded. "I am sorry, Alex, that I wasn't able to be of more help on this. Hope there could be other ways that you get to meet with him." Over the next few weeks, I desperately tried to salvage the situation. An early Facebook employee I had met at Summit contacted Zuckerberg's security team. Bill Gates' office contacted Zuckerberg's assistant. Matt Mickelson, the founder of Lady Gaga's social network, whom I met through Elliot, introduced me to one of Zuckerberg's attorneys. Matt then took me to Facebook headquarters to meet with the company's chief marketing officer. Still, there was no word from Zuckerberg. As months passed, what killed me most about this failure was the lack of closure. There was no post-mortem. A part of me felt that I never had a good strategy in the first place. This hadn't even been a real meeting with Zuckerberg. His email basically implied he would shake my hand and talk for a minute. That was great, but I should have asked Chi to introduce me to Zuckerberg's chief of staff, someone whom I could sit down with, explain what I was doing, and who could then set up a full interview. But another part of me knew that it didn't matter. Even if it was just a minute-long meeting, Chi Lu had thrown me a perfect Hail Mary. I had caught it at the one-yard line with no defenders around. All I had to do was take two steps forward to the end zone. But I still fumbled. Chapter 34. The Greatest Gift. I beat myself up for weeks, thinking about sitting under that tree, failing to meet Zuckerberg. Then I thought about how I sent that shoe, failing to back off from Buffett. And even when I had managed to get to Bill Gates, I failed to ask the right questions. There were moments when I felt like my journey was one long, pathetic string of mistakes. But I stopped thinking about my pain as soon as I was in the presence of Quincy Jones.
"Where are you from, my man?"
His deep, 81-year-old voice landed on my ears like the notes of a baritone sax. Quincy wore a royal blue robe that swept down to his ankles. I sat beside him on a sofa in the circular living room of his Bel Air home. "Born and raised in L.A., I replied. "No," he shook his head.
"I said, where are you from?"
My parents are from Iran.
"That's what I thought."
"How'd you know?" Instead of answering directly, he launched into a wild story about his travels in Iran when he was 18, attending parties thrown by the Shah, and sneaking out at night meeting up with young revolutionaries trying to break the Ayatollah out of jail. Then he told me the story of when he dated a Persian princess.
"Khili mamnoon," Quincy said, laughing as he tossed out phrases in Persian. "I was in Tehran, Damascus, Beirut, Iraq, Karachi, everywhere. I've been traveling for 65 years, all over the planet."
I had researched his background before this interview, but now I was realizing how little I truly knew about the man. I already knew he had been nominated for more Grammy Awards than any other music producer in history. I knew he had produced Michael Jackson's Thriller, the highest-grossing album of all time, as well as We Are the World, the highest-grossing single of all time. He had worked with some of the greatest performers of the 20th century, from Frank Sinatra to Paul McCartney to Ray Charles. In the world of film, he produced The Color Purple with Steven Spielberg, which was nominated for 10 Oscars. In television, he created The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which was nominated for an Emmy. As a mentor, he helped launch the careers of Will Smith and Oprah Winfrey. Quincy Jones is undeniably one of the most important figures in the history of entertainment, and now he was asking me,
"You got a pen?"
I pulled one out of my pocket. He grabbed a sheet of paper from under the coffee table. He began drawing curvy letters, teaching me how to write in Arabic. Then he taught me how to write in Mandarin. Then Japanese. I had hated learning languages in school, yet Quincy made them seem as if they were the keys to the universe.
"Look here," he said, pointing up to the living room's arched ceiling.
12 large wooden beams radiated from the center like rays from the sun.
"That's feng shui," he said. "They symbolize the 12 notes of the musical scale, the 12 apostles, the 12 signs of the zodiac."
He pointed around the room. Surrounding us were dozens of ancient-looking artifacts. A Chinese sculpture of a boy on a horse, a bust of an Egyptian queen, and each of them seemed to have its own vortex of energy.
"I've got Nefertiti over there," Quincy said. "I've got Buddha there. The Tang Dynasty is there. Japan there. That's Picasso there. Over there, that's my model of the original SpaceX rocket. Elon gave me that. He's my neighbor."
My head spun and Quincy smiled, as though he knew something about me that I didn't.
"It's a hell of a world out there," he said. "You've got to go to know."
Our conversation moved faster and faster. One second he was talking about meditation, the next about nanotechnology. One minute he was talking about architecture.
"Frank Gehry always says to me, he's a Pisces too. He says, if architecture is frozen music, then music must be liquid architecture. All great art is emotional architecture."
And then the next he was talking about directing.
"When Spielberg came to my studio,
He said he directs the same way I conduct. He creates a strong structure. And on top of that, he improvises. You have to give people room to put their personalities on it.
Gems of wisdom kept dropping, and I sat back on the couch, absorbing each one.
I teach the musicians I mentor to become themselves, to know themselves, and to love themselves. That's all I care about. Know yourself and love yourself. Young people are always chasing. It's because they think they're in control of everything. They have to learn to be connected to the universe. Just let it happen to you. There's a statute of limitations that's expired on all childhood traumas. Fix your shit and get on with your life.
Quincy reached under the coffee table for a book. He flipped through the pages of black and white pictures.
Chicago in the 30s, he said, pointing to the photos. This is where I spent my childhood. My daddy was a carpenter for the most notorious black gangsters on the planet. They didn't fuck around, man. I wanted to be a gangster when I was young. I saw guns and dead bodies every day.
He pulled up his sleeve and pointed to a scar on the back of his hand.
You see that? 7 years old. I went to the wrong block. Some guys took a knife, used it to nail my hand to a fence, and then stuck an ice pick in the back of my head. I thought I was gonna die.
Some summers, his dad took him to Louisville to visit his grandmother, a former slave. She would tell Quincy to go to the river and grab rats that still had their tails moving. She fried the rats with onions on her coal stove for dinner. When Quincy was 10, his family moved to Seattle. One night, when he and his friends were breaking into a recreation center to steal food, he stumbled into a room with a piano. It was the first time he had seen one. When Quincy's fingers touched the keys, he remembers it feeling like a moment of the divine.
Everything changed for me, he said. I loved music so much, I wrote songs until my eyes would bleed.
Quincy learned to play any instrument he could get his hands on. Violin, clarinet, trumpet, sousaphone, B-flat baritone horn, E-flat alto peck horn, French horn, and trombone. He began sneaking into nightclubs to meet jazz musicians who passed through town. When he was 14, Quincy slipped into a club and met a blind teenager who was 2 years older. They hit it off, and the older teen began to mentor Quincy. They became close friends. That blind teenager was Ray Charles.
I met McCartney when he was 22, Elton John, 17, Mick Jagger, all those guys. I found Leslie Gore when she was 16.
Leslie Gore's It's My Party, which Quincy produced, was one of the biggest songs of 1963. How did you find her? I asked.
Through her uncle, who was mafia. He went to Joe Glazier, who worked with Al Capone. Back when I came up, everything in music was mafia. The booking agencies with Duke Ellington, Louis Armstrong, Lionel Hampton, all mafia. It was fucked up, man. There were exploitations of blacks like you cannot believe. Back then is when I learned that if you don't have a master, a negative, or a copyright, you're not in the music business. I learned the hard way.
Quincy had composed 10 original songs for the iconic band leader Count Basie. A music executive named Morris Levy called Quincy into his office to sign a publishing contract. The contract was on the table, and all of Levy's cronies were behind him.
You can ask for anything you want, he told Quincy, but you're only getting 1%. I signed the contract, Quincy told me, and before I walked out of his office, he owned all my shit.
Quincy laughed gently as if recounting a fond memory, but for some reason, I felt my whole body stiffen.
I was young and I learned my lesson, Quincy said. The second time I did Basie's album, he asked me, what are we going to do about the publishing? I told him, nothing. I'll publish it myself. He said, now you're getting smart, kid. Why didn't you think of that the first time?
Quincy laughed some more.
The mafia took all my shit, he added. I'm still getting it back.
That's fucked up, I said, my anger surprising us both. With hindsight, I can see where it came from. I was still so upset over what happened with Zuckerberg that even the smallest reminder of being screwed by someone in a position of power set me off.